Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I wanted to fill you in on something we're going to be doing this week on the MedicCast. Since it's summertime here in North America, and many people are finished school and maybe heading into summer clinicals, or have graduated and are working as a probationary EMT or paramedic in their first job, I thought I would look at working with a preceptor. What is expected of you as a student or as a new employee, as the preceptee, and what you can expect from a good preceptor. And I think this is a great time to do that. So this is from an episode of the MedicCast Live from a little over a year ago. Some of you may have been around and listened to this episode, but there's a lot of good information in here from the MedicCast Live panel, and I think it will be something that's well-received by everyone. It's not in the feed anymore, so anybody that's relatively new will not be able to go back and get the back episode. So I thought I'd bring it forward and refresh the information there. So that's what's going to be in line for this week's episode of the MedicCast, and I'll be back again next week with another full episode of the show.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Pod Medic, Jamie Davis.
Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and welcome back to another episode of the MedicCast Live. This month, in June, we're going to be talking about precepting, roles and responsibilities on both sides of the fence. And I guess another subtitle might be how to get the most out of your clinicals. So I've got some special guests here this evening. I have Rick Rosati from the Mitigation Journal podcast, and I also have Peter Canning, who is a well-known blogger and author of books on EMS, and Peter's going to be sharing with us some of his experiences in the world, both as a preceptor and a preceptee. So I want to welcome everybody to the show. And I'm going to go ahead and unmute everybody, and I guess I'll go ahead and say, Peter, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Jamie.
Excellent. And Rick, you as well. It's always nice to have you on the show.
Thanks, Jamie.
And Medic March, can I have your first name and a little bit about you?
Absolutely. First name's Chance. Freshly cleared paramedic. Actually, freshly cleared, I say that. Trying to get cleared paramedic down here in central Louisiana, south Louisiana, south central.
Oh, excellent. Well, it's a pleasure to have you here on the show, and it'll be interesting to hear your thoughts on precepting and how you've done in your clinical process and thoughts you have. I want to start off a little bit about with kind of a definition of preceptor and precepting in general. First of all, precepting doesn't appear in the dictionary, although I found plenty of references to it. So they need to get themselves on the ball a little bit better. But if you look up the word preceptor, you get a preceptor is simply a noun that refers to a teacher or instructor. And I think that's really what it comes down to. And of course, you know, it really is just that much. It's nothing more than that. It's a teacher or instructor. But it can be a whole lot more than that. And so I thought we'd kind of throw it out to the group here, the people here in the talk cast, exactly what you think some of the main attributes you might find in a preceptor. And I guess I'll start here with Peter. You're in the process of precepting somebody right now, aren't you?
Here with her. She's trying to listen in, but
okay. Well, what would like?
I've had a very pleasurable experience this time precepting. The person that I was precepting, I worked in the ER for a number of years, and the amount of knowledge that she picked up was really great. So that when we actually got into the precepting thing about how to handle patients and even the medical knowledge, it was just more fine-tuning as far as tricks of the trade.
Well, and that's you know, that always makes it easier. I mean, prior medical knowledge just makes a huge bit of difference. Also, prior experience in EMS, even if you're moving into paramedic, if you've been in EMTB for a while, that can all make a difference. Rick, I'm going to go ahead and throw this to you. Peter talked about patients and I guess a little bit about setting the model for what the new person in EMS should be. What are your thoughts on what a preceptor should be?
Well, I think the ideal preceptor has to not only have those values, but has to have the ability to walk the walk, I guess I would say, to embrace and embody those key values in their personal life as well as their practice. And those are the people that should be setting the example. And, you know, they have to practice what they preach and live with their teaching to others and not just expect the preceptee to follow commands and do as I say, not as I do mentality.
Yeah, I think role modeling is another one I came up with, and that's exactly it. I think we really – when you precept somebody, I think being a role model is one of the things, trying to be the person that they can look up to and aspire to, and maybe point out others that are role models as well. And so, and again, Medic March, what was your name again? Just so I can get it here on the podcast and get it right.
Name's Chance out of
Louisiana, right? Okay. Chance, you're...
I don't have an accent. It probably throws you off.
Well, it's the recent technical difficulties, which if you're downloading this talk cast, you will not know what happened, but we had a dropout and I had to reconnect. And, so Chance, you're recently out of clinicals or still in them at the tail end?
I've been being precepted for two shifts. To eventually clear as paramedic and they give me my own ambulance.
Okay. So what are you looking for or what were you thinking about what you would like to see in a preceptor? What were some of the things you were looking for?
Well, something that I looked for whenever, you know, I was looking for my preceptor and I managed to find was a really good combination of knowledge and what I felt, you know, what I see is almost a leadership quality, because I find that inspiring to me. Somebody else who can lead, it inspires me to try to develop those own qualities in myself. But like I said, somebody very knowledgeable about that job, but also somebody who I felt I could get along with. I wouldn't be afraid to ask a question. It's a big experience. It's a learning experience, and you can't be afraid to ask somebody a question or afraid that you'll get chewed for asking a question. But at the same time, the preceptor that I've been working with, although we get along very well, I'm grateful for this. I don't think he would be afraid to, you know, chew my hind end if I really needed it. I'd have to accept that as constructive criticism. So those are what that's what I kind of look for when I was trying to select a preceptor. And lucky enough, I found not just one, but two that I feel embody those qualities. So I'm very lucky.
Now, did you get to select your own preceptor?
There's not so much a selection process for the company I worked for, but you can kind of, you know, they're real kind of laid back. It's like you can talk to your FTO about who you'd like to be working with. They say, well, okay, they'll put their good graces on it. And then, of course, if it isn't working, they'll switch you around, or if there's problems, they'll switch you around. But mostly, It seems that system's worked out pretty well in our company and has been producing some young, if well-rounded paramedics.
I like that, where you can sort of get, you know, put yourself with somebody you're compatible with. We used to be that way, but recently, or a couple of years ago, our union put in a contract that we had a list of 10 preceptors, and you had, as people came eligible to be precepted, they had to go with whoever was on the top of the list so that everybody was rotated. And the problem with that is sometimes you get people that, you know, you may not be the most compatible with, where before a certain preceptee might be someone who needed discipline or someone who might particularly needed confidence instilled in them, and the chief paramedic was able to match people up by what he thought would be the best the best pairs. And I think that's a much better system than just randomly matching people.
Yeah, I have to agree. I think that's really a bonus there, Chance, that you get to at least have a little bit of choice, at least in your selection process. And I think that helps you match up with somebody that has some of the traits that you're looking to build in yourself. And you touched on some really important things, being a leader and having experience, but also being willing to be a disciplinarian. And these are all things that I had put on the list as I was brainstorming about the different duties and aspects of being a preceptor. And discipline came up because I guess you need to be prepared to if somebody did something wrong and it was a glaring error, you need to be prepared to lay down the law and say, absolutely do not do that again if it need be. And we also have with Claiborne on the line. And with, nice to see you there. I'm unmuting you so you can say
hi. Hello.
How you doing?
Hi.
Anybody who listened to this past week's show will probably heard Wyth's interview about her trip to D.C. So, Wyth, thank you very much for joining in. We're talking about preceptors and precepting, and you're in the process right now. You're an EMTB, and you're in the process of doing some of your clinicals?
Yes, I have preceptors now.
And we're talking about some of the things that we're looking for in preceptors. And we've had words come up like knowledgeable, patience, role model, and leader. Is there anything you might add to that?
I like it when they don't leave you alone to do it all yourself. I realize there's a point, but again, I'm at the beginning of having preceptors, and a lot of them are just like, oh, go do that. And I'm like, can you show me?
And is it, what kind of things do they send you to do? I mean, when you feel that way, is it a skill that you learned in the classroom but really haven't put in practice in the field, or what kind of
things?
Okay. So you'd like them to be accountable, I guess would be a word to use there.
Yeah.
And a resource for training, you know, actual physical training.
Yeah, because that's a whole lot different.
It is. And, you know, it's funny, depending on what you did before you got involved with EMS, if you have some prior experience, you might not have some of the reluctance to do invasive procedures or like, and, you know, some of us are probably thinking invasive procedures like IVs, but, you know, the first time I stuck an IV in somebody, I was scared to death. And, so I think that it's it's something that needs to be mentioned, that the preceptor needs to be a good judge of somebody else's comfort level, I guess, would be something additional. Something else I came up with when I was doing my list, I came up with the idea of being a professional, that, you know, the preceptor needs to be a professional in how they conduct themselves. So that, again, that falls back into that role model. But professional performance of your job, professional appearance, all those things, I think, lend quite a bit to what can help somebody be a good preceptor. I see we have Chris joining us in the chat room there, EZ822. It's nice to see you there, Chris. So anyway, let's move over to the other side of the fence here. And I'm going to start with Chance, since this is something that he's involved with, and then maybe we'll touch base with as well. What do you look for? What do you see in yourself as attributes you want to have as a preceptee, as somebody that's going into that clinical as a student? Go ahead, Chance, and let me, if you have any thoughts on that.
In myself, I am. Man, I just really hope that I don't screw up too bad. just trying to keep my head together and relax for me is a big part of precepting. I mean, right now when I'm in the back of the patient, my preceptors have been saying I've been doing all right, but I mean, we practically need orange floaties and a lifeguard back there. I sweat so much it turns into a little swimming pool in the back. I guess what you need for a preceptee going in is just keep your ears and eyes open, and just be willing to take constructive criticism, because you're going to get some whether you like it or not. just be open to what people are trying to tell you, because some of these people have been doing it for longer, and some are very much longer than you have, and they haven't just breezed through. Most of them, they experience things, and they're trying to help you out. So just listen, and just relax and listen, and try not to be too nervous.
and that's, I think that's key for anybody that moves into a different level of training and has to add new skills to their bag of tricks. With anything to add to that?
No, I think relax. He has right on key. That's my biggest flaw at this point is I can know as much as I know about drug dosages, et cetera, but when I know I'm messing up, I start getting a little bit uneasy. So relax and just be confident in yourself is the biggest thing at this point as a preceptee.
Yeah, you know, I always tell people when I talk about taking any kind of practical test or anything like that, and I think practical test is what you're doing as a clinical. It just happens to be on live patients, but is that take a deep breath is just the one of those things that if you can do, just take a deep breath and then go forward and get back to your ABCs. That's what Chris is saying in the chat room. Take a breath and go back to your ABCs. I think that's absolutely 100% correct. I'm going to go ahead and throw this out to Pete because he's in the process of precepting somebody right now. And Peter, you know, when you're in the back of the ambulance and you got somebody with acute coronary syndrome or an MI or something going on, and you look over at your student and they're more diaphoretic than your patient is, what do you do? How do you set them at ease, or is there something that you try to keep in mind and help them with that situation?
Geez, I don't know. My current preceptee, I haven't had that problem with. In the past, I guess I've had some people with that, and I've just tried to, you know, just whisper to them to relax. If I felt they got a little bit, if they got off track a little bit, I might nudge them back in the right way. If they were forgetting something, I might, you know, hold up the bottle of aspirin or hand over the 12 lead cables. But I think part of the precepting thing is when you start is you tell your preceptee that you're going to fall flat on your face a time or two and not worry about it, that it's not going to be over if you don't get the tube. It's not going to be over if you mess up on a call, because precepting is about that. It's a buffer zone between school and when you have to do it on your own, and it's a time for you to fail and to learn from that failure. I'm going to pass the phone over here to my preceptee, Tamara. She has something she wants to add.
Great. Welcome, Tamara. And it's good to have you on the show. And what are your thoughts as you're in the process of a student in a precepting situation right now on what you'd, what you'd like to add in here to the conversation?
I think that Peter is an awesome preceptor because when we started, he was more present. He had more of a presence in the back and by no means held my hand. He has always let me do my own thing, but he was right there in the CPR seat across from me, and that's how we started. And then he faded back more and more progressively. But, for example, the first time we gave Cardizem, he knew that I had never done that before. So even though he was sitting up in the front seat some of the times, at that point he came right in the back that time. He knew that I was going to need him there, and he knew that he was going to need to show me some things. You know, yes, I knew the dosages. Yes, I knew my drip for afterwards. That's great. But he's like, we don't ever give Cardizem without two lines. He was like right there with me, you know, as my partner, still letting me give the drugs, still letting me draw it up, still letting me start my own lines and everything, but he was there. He knew that I needed him. The next call came, it was a routine medical. He might go back up front again. So he was really in tune to what I needed, which was awesome.
Yeah, and that, I think that's a good point, that you really almost – you need to remember back to when you were that student and were wondering, what do I do next? Or you look like you might draw a blank. And that's – it's something that we need to share with our students and the people we ride with is, you know, as Chris says in the chat room, it's not a crime to look things up. I know I am always famous – around with my kids for quoting. Einstein's used to say quite a few times that he never committed anything to memory he could write down on paper. And in fact, he carried several notebooks around with him where he jotted down facts that he needed to use but didn't need to memorize because he had his notebooks with him. And I think that's one of the reasons we carry pocket protocols and pocket guides and things like drip charts. Anybody who's ever worked in a hospital setting knows that they have drip charts for every medication. They don't think of it and try to come do the math in their head and come up with the drip rates. All that information is spelled out for them right there. So I agree absolutely that that's one of the things you need to be aware of and not be afraid to ask for help. Is there anything else you'd like to add to your list of attributes of a good preceptee?
I think he hit it on the head when he said patience. I mean, that's so important. He had more patience with me than I did at some point. I can tell you, you know, after the first IV, I would have been very happy. After missing my first IV, I would have been rather content just throwing up my hands and letting him come in and do it. But having to work through that second IV and looking for that vein for the second time with that bit of anxiety behind you because you just missed the first one makes the second experience a whole lot different. And it is something that is good to go through with a preceptor there, you know. So I think that that patience was huge. And like I said, he had more patience with me, I think, than I did sometimes.
Chance, if I could add something onto that.
Go ahead.
Also, just reassuring your preceptee if they screw up. I mean, the first night after, I went home and kind of curled up in a ball around my national registry patch and cried a little bit. And the second day, she knew I was kind of nervous about a call I'd run the day before. And we sat down and talked about it. And she's like, "Well, what felt you did wrong and all that stuff?" We talked about it. And she's like, "Well, yeah, you did this, and this. But the thing is, the patient was in good humor whenever she got back. Whenever she got to the ER, you know, you had a laugh and she was doing a lot better than when, you know, we picked her up. She was in a good mood, not really nervous. You put her at ease. And, at the very least, you managed to pull that off, which can do wonders for somebody's state." So she was able to reassure me on that after I was sure I had just totally nuked the call one day. And so she was nice enough to reassure me and get me back in a row as far as my confidence.
Yeah, and that's I think the big thing is self-confidence is one of those items that I think preceptees need to have, often it's one of the things that they really need to have built up. It's not that it's not there, it's just that it just needs to be built up and there're going to be those times when you're going to fall flat on your face, and that's exactly the time when the preceptor needs to come in there and give that constructive criticism. Rick, you're doing a lot with training right now and you're in your service, and you know, do you have any thoughts to add on what you'd look for in a preceptee, some things you'd like to see and things you think that need to be propped up sometimes?
Well, I like to see someone that's not only academically strong, but skill-wise has a good skill set come to the training ground. And I also enjoy someone that comes there with an open mind to different learning styles or to the practical side of EMS provision. That is, they realize or are able to gain an appreciation for the fact that not everything that's taught in the classroom is carried out exactly so in the street, and they can get what they have in their head and their knowledge base out through their hands. I take a little bit different approach towards the preceptor or the preceptee, and that is I set the stage with them ahead of time as far as what their expectations are, what my expectations of them are going to be, and I get from them what they really need to work on, what they feel their strengths and weaknesses are ahead of time before we ever set foot in the ambulance. And when we get there, I make it clear to the preceptee that I'm there to help them succeed, and furthermore, I'm there to be their safety net, and that this is, for all intents and purposes, a training shift, but it is live patient training, and mistakes count, and they'll never be embarrassed with me, and they'll never be allowed off the hook either with me. And that being said, when a challenging situation comes up, they need to know that I'll be right there next to them to help guide them and they're gonna have a positive learning experience no matter what happens, and they're gonna walk away from that with something that they can share with other people down the road.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you bring up a good point, and I'm sure that this is pretty common, but I know in my service I have quite a few new EMTs that are finishing up at the end of the school semester, and I think that, you know, one of the things I try to do is sit down with them each individually before they start going out and riding as EMTBs and getting their calls with preceptors, is to remind them that you know they are going to make some errors. They're, just because they have their EMT card from the state of Maryland doesn't mean that they are expected to know every single thing that comes down the pike. We all know the longer we've been in this business, the more we realize that we're not ever going to see it all, that there's always going to be that call that just leaves us scratching our head or leaves us with worrying about how we're going to get, you know, the job done with what we have in front of us. So I think that's, you know, that's something we need to keep in mind as well. And I'm sure that's something that other services do. But you're right. You need to sit down with them and lay out expectations and to begin with. Some other things I thought about as I was looking at putting this podcast together was looking at training in the field and the fact that there really needs to be, for each service, some clearly laid out rules and regulations on how that process is handled. I guess I'm going to throw this out to Rick again. What kind of things do you consider, you know, important to be written into guidelines on the relationship in training between a preceptor and a preceptee?
Well, we use something like a learning contract. And in that learning contract, it defines what the system expectations are as far as number of calls, types of patient contacts, chronological requirements, skills requirements, and we also have an agency-specific learning contract, which looks at the knowledge of the service and the policies and procedures, and that helps, because then the student or the preceptee comes into the training scenario or into the training shift with what I would think that learning contract then becomes a study guide for them, and outlines what they have to have, and both the preceptor and the preceptee sign off on that. It is just as it sounds, a learning contract. So I know what I'm responsible for delivering to this student, and that student knows what to expect of me, and vice versa.
Yeah, and you know, learning contract is a great way to go. I hadn't even thought about that. I was thinking more about, you know, like how we need to really go over safety for the individual units, but when we get out of the classroom and get into the real world environment, every ambulance is different. Every ambulance company is a little bit different in the way that they handle things. Where are the safety supplies? You know, I end up every show with Scene Safety BSI. And I know, Rick, you've said, you know, that's something that we say so much, we don't know what it means anymore. And I have to agree with you there, but you know, it is something that we need to always keep in the forefront of our minds. And so that's something we need to look for, and clearly documenting what the training relationship is going to be. Have that contract, like you said, even spelled out so that everything's squared away to begin with. Peter, do you have anything to add to that? Things that you think are important as far as general guidelines and how to define that relationship?
Yeah, we don't really do much along those lines. Generally, our preceptee has a certain number of calls that they're expected to do, and they like to get a well-rounded, they like to get a, you know, code, a good trauma, a CHF, just sort of cover the gamut of things. And it's just they're cut loose when the preceptee and the preceptor together decide that they'll be comfortable. But we don't have any rigid checkbox, anything like that. In many cases, the person we're precepting has worked at our company as a basic for a while, so they're pretty well familiar with things.
And that's a good point too. I know in our area you have to have a certain number of calls before you can even go and take the paramedic program here. And so you have a certain amount of BLS skill under your belt. And this is something, with, that you talked about in our interview last week, about how you really wanted to be an EMTB first and get those basic skills under your belt before you jumped up to paramedic. And I think that's just very valuable. I see a concrete difference between the people that go to a 2-year or 4-year school, go straight through to get their paramedic without really riding a lot of BLS calls along the way. And it seems to me like they're way too quick to jump to ALS interventions in my experience. And I think that's sometimes something that we forget to point out to people. I have another question to kind of throw out there. How do you document the performance? Peter, you were saying they have to write a certain number of calls, and you'd like to see a variety of calls of different natures, codes, traumas, CHF patients, etc. Do you have a way of documenting that? Do you use a special skill sheet that you fill out and it goes into the person's file, or is it something you just kind of document and keep track of between the two of you?
They have a standard form that we're supposed to fill out after every call, but I had some objections to it. So basically what I've worked out with our medical control is probably once or twice a week I just write a general report based on how they're doing, as opposed to filling that thing out after every call, because I think it's a person's rated better after a week as opposed to you did this well on this call, you didn't do well on this one. And I was really uncomfortable with those, and I think it's worked very well. I think it takes some of the pressure off of the preceptee, and it allows a much more generalized approach to some of the better things that they're doing or the different. If you're evaluating on every call, you tend to get into, well, was the IV successful, was the IV unsuccessful? Where if you're evaluating after a period of calls, you can say, yes, well, this preceptee is doing very well with patient rapport, they're managing the scene well, and you can rate them in more of the important areas that that aren't so skill-centered. Does that make sense?
It absolutely does, because I think, we're going to miss tubes. We're going to miss IVs in the field. I mean, I don't know anybody out there that says they're 100% on everything. And there's going to be those calls where you just miss something important and don't get it, on the call. But it's how you handle yourself when you come up to that adversity that I think is more telling, because it's how we improvise in the field that makes the difference when it comes up to handling the difficult calls. And we all can train and know our protocols forwards and backwards and be able to recite dosages, but it comes down to really how are we going to handle ourselves when everything hits the fan.
Right, Jamie, you read the Baby Medics blog, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Did you see that column he had the other day about he's getting rated, he's getting bar graphs on how well he's doing his IVs and on different things. And I guess he titled it like zeros and ones. And he basically, I think reading between the lines, he was trying to say that there's more to being a paramedic than, number scores on each call.
I have to agree completely with that, and I did see that, and I thought personally that was going a bit overboard. But some people like to crunch the data. Some people are numbers people, and I can certainly understand if he's got a preceptor that likes to look at that kind of information. My challenge would be, if I was that person for the last, if I was him for the last week and a half, I have been 2 IV guy for the last 10 days. I mean, I almost feel like I just should just, instantly throw the first catheter into the sharps box, because it's not going to work anyway. And I know we all go through that, because that's one of the things I tell people. Look, you're going to hit spells where you just think you can't find pipeline IVs no matter how hard you try. And yet there's other days and weeks that go by where I feel like, I'm like some kind of blind kung fu master, nailing IVs left and right.
That's very true.
And I think that some of that is just comes down to the confidence factor that you need to know that you're going to miss some things. And I think that you're right. Sometimes too much information is not what the job necessarily entails, but some people thrive on that kind of information, and maybe that's a communication barrier when you provide information that the person's not really looking for. I guess here's another question I'll throw out there, and maybe we'll start off with our preceptees in the audience, and we also have a new person in the chat room, DVAEMTP. So if you have any comments, you can type them in on the chat room there. And if you want to call in and have some comments directly on the audio, please go ahead and do so. My next question really is going to go out to, I guess, With and Chance to start here. And I guess I'll let Chance go first here. At what point do you want the preceptor to step in? I mean, there are those times where you want to throw your hands up and you're not feeling confident in yourself anymore. Is there a point where you really wish they'd step in, or do you think they need to let you sit out there and swim for a while, tread water until you get back on your feet on your own?
Well, I've been very lucky to be stuck with not just one, but two preceptors who I get along with pretty well. My preceptor was able to look at me the other day. We had a pretty bad call. A lady with a respiratory rate of about 40, moving no air, chronic emphysema, just really bad COPD. And I was first in the house with the monitor and the bag and everything. And she was right behind me, and she saw me look up as soon as I tried listening to her lung sounds and everything. She saw me look up, and I guess, I don't know, was able to see herself and my pupils, because I know they must have been huge. And she looks down and goes, just take a deep breath. You can do it. And she locked us all up in the back and got us there. And I treated the lady pretty well. We're about 4 or 5 minutes from the hospital. I gave her a treatment, a conjugate treatment and everything. And I thought maybe she was starting to go out on me. I started prepping my intubation stuff. And she's keeping an eye on me through the mirror. And I went back to grabbing my IV stuff, and this lady had beautiful veins, but I just could not get a stick at all. And finally we got to the hospital, and she opened up the back doors and looked at me, and I said, please help me, please stick an IV for me. And she said, absolutely, okay. And she sticks it, of course, on the first try. We bring our lady in. She ends up getting intubated about 30 minutes later. But we talked about it after, and I was just like, thank you for letting me take my shot at it. She didn't step in until I asked her to, which I appreciate that she trusts me that much, to let me take a swing at it as far as I can and take over whenever I say, look, I can't do it. I need your help. So for her to be able to recognize that, I think is, what I need personally as my personal form of precepting. I mean, I realize it may go totally different for somebody else, but I feel like that's what I need for my preceptor. And she's been very good about letting me kind of make my own dishwater and then soak in it.
Now, is that something you set up in advance, or is that something you talked about before you went out in the field at the beginning of your session with this particular preceptor, or is this something that she just seemed to be pretty perceptive about?
It's something I think that this lady is great. She's I've been calling her mom the past couple of days, because she's everything I need. I mean, she really kind of takes care of me, but at the same time, it's not like taking care of a baby where she does everything for me. It's where she says, I mean, she said, to answer your question, she said, the first day, look, you're here, I'm going to let you do what you need to do, and if you need help, tell me, and I'll help you. She's very clear about letting me perform as far as I was comfortable, and then if I needed help, she would help me. She was very clear about that, but at the same time, she's like, she told me, I'm not going to run all your calls for you. I mean, you've reached this point now where you should be able to at least do a little bit of this without assistance. So, go to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, it's interesting that you say that, because it's one of those things I think that some new preceptors get hung up on is jumping in too early, trying to be too helpful. With, do you have anything to add to that?
I am still in the point where I'm in the classroom and on clinical sites, so I'm not, like, in the back of the truck by myself, thank God. But I respond to disappointment best. When I don't know something, having my preceptor, he's very militaristic, and he's very clear about how disappointed he is, and I didn't think I would respond well to it, but I hate not knowing everything, so it just motivates me to go out and study that much more before the next time so that whatever he pulls out, I can answer, and, you know, if I kill the patient, at least it's only a mannequin so far.
Yeah, absolutely. And Chris brings up a good point in the chat room is that, you know, the idea of having two different preceptors is a good idea because you get to see different things and another point of view. My IV technique was pretty decent, I like to think, but it got so much better when I worked in an ER and had contact with about 10 different nurses on a regular basis. And all of them had slightly different things they did to get those difficult lines. And I was able to pull that collection together and have it in my bag of tricks to try at different times. And that's the difficulty when you're a paramedic, you rarely ride with other paramedics unless it's a really critical call. And you're not going to get an opportunity to share that knowledge with each other very frequently. It's not an opportunity to do that like you would in another situation. And with, I want to thank you for joining the show and heading out. She's got to get some more studying done, but I do appreciate you sharing that information with us today.
Thank you.
So we're going to jump right on into some other thoughts here. And I'd like to get the idea from the other side, from the people that have been preceptors. Peter, do you have any thoughts about, you know, what do you look for when you think it's important, a good time to jump in and not take over, but lend a hand?
What the patient needs, they're not getting, and time is running short. That's when I might jump in. Because I don't know, it's a tough thing in some cases if, you know, the patient is heading south, and in one sense, you want your preceptee to have the experience of handling it completely. But on the other hand, you don't want to put the patient at risk. So there might be times where you'll be helping the preceptee, taking a step. Not waiting for them I guess I'm being a little jumbled here. It's sometimes you may just have to jump to it before they'll get to it, and you may believe that they'll get to it, but you really can't afford the, you know, waiting the 15 or 30 seconds that it might take for them to arrive at that point. For instance, you might pull out the intubation gear, or you might complete the sentence for them in certain situations. But in a lot of cases, you know, it's best to just sit back.
Yeah, and it is difficult to know when to do that because, like you said, they need to know how to deal with those patients that are circling the drain, that they're really, you're not sure, you're pretty confident that they're going to be difficult patient even in the hospital setting, and to handle it in the back of an ambulance as a brand new medic trying out your skills for the first time is a challenge, but it's again something that we all have to learn because it's going to happen to us and we're not going to have backup there. So you're right. It's a fine line. Anything to add there, Rick?
Yeah, I think Peter said it pretty well. We don't want to let the patient go without something that, that they may need. But my threshold for jumping in with a preceptor or with a preceptee is different for every preceptee based on their knowledge and experience level and how they've been doing in the program thus far. I don't, certainly don't want to let anyone out of a situation too early or jump in too early and deprive them of the learning experience, but certainly not too late either and have mistakes be made or items be missed. I always use the same phrase with my preceptees, and I tell them this up front, and I tell them if I ever ask if I can help with something, can I help you with that? Can I help you get the IV? Can I help you put the oxygen on? That's a hint that it's time for me to step in. And that way the preceptee is the only one that knows that it's time for me to intervene. And they're not embarrassed in front of the patient. They're not embarrassed in front of the family and certainly other responders. No one will ever know but me and that preceptee that it was time for a shifting of gears to take place. One thing I always do at each and every job I go on when I'm precepting someone is I watch the expressions on their face and on the face of the patient, the family, and the bystanders. More than technical competence or didactic knowledge, if we start to be losing the confidence of those around us, it's time to change gears.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, there's nothing worse on a full code than a paramedic who's a screamer. I had an unfortunate situation as an EMTB where I was involved in a code where the paramedic shouted everything and made it a whole lot more tense than it needed to be, and added to the overall, you know, the way we handled the call because of the tension level we all felt based on their response. And that's true. You know, you're right that the overall response of the bystanders, the family members, the other responders to what's going on, you know, it comes back to that leadership segment and the fact that we're developing leadership in our students, but also that we need to exhibit that leadership quality ourselves. And, you know, I had an instructor tell me when I was in paramedic school that the most important thing to ever do in a critical situation was to stop, pause for a couple of seconds and take a deep breath. And we come back to that deep breath again, but it allows you to get back on the target and to refocus yourself. And you do it in such a way that the quiet calms everybody down. And so I agree with you. I think that, and that's a great point also, Rick, on how you bring that up to the person, that you say to them, hey, you know, can I help you out with this, or can I help you out with this next thing? And that's a great code phrase to use with a student that doesn't clue the patient in that there's something that the student might be floundering or might be looking for an assistance. So that's a good point. Does anybody else have anything to add to this particular part of the discussion?
I just wanted to say, this is Chance. My old partner that I had was telling me a story whenever she was going through her precepting. Maybe on her sixth or seventh day of actual precepting, her preceptor threw her in the back with a trauma complete, and he set up an IV for her and then stood up and said, sink or swim, and hopped out of the module, hopped in the front of the cab, closed the window in the back, hit the lights and sirens, and my partner just kind of stood there with a 14 gauge in her hand, just kind of frozen for a minute. But it was just the motivation she needed to work that call, and she ended up doing very well on the call. But you know, a humorous story that I find pretty amusing about precepting and assisting a preceptor, because I mean, he hopped right in the front and just slammed on the gas.
can I chime in on that one for a minute, Jamie?
Absolutely.
You know, that technique may work with some folks, and it sounds like, you know, from my vantage point, that your partner there may have gotten lucky. It's just as easy that we would have turned somebody off to being an EMS provider or, you know, irreparably damaged someone's career by allowing them to make a mistake in that training environment. And let's face it, it is live patient training. I don't care what we call it. But it does not have to be hell on earth. And to put the patient and the preceptee or the student in that position, I think is, well, really borderline on practice.
I would say that I did get a chance to talk to her preceptor about it later, and he said he felt, I think it's about reading people, he felt like it was the motivation that she needed to just get more confident as a medic. And as you said, it is kind of dangerous. I mean, she ends up doing well. It ends up being a funny story. But there's definitely, you know, you can see there where it could have gone the wrong way.
Well, it comes down.
It comes down to
the difference between what's an entry level person and what's a mediocre person. We expect certain entry level skills or mastery in some skills at the new or entry level paramedic. But there's got to be a point where those entry level skills don't progress any further, and that becomes mediocrity. And that's where the really I think that the better quality preceptors are going to nurture the individual out of that mediocrity and into a good career.
Well, it's a difficult job we do as paramedics and also as EMTBs, because when you're alone in the back of the unit, you're it. You're the only one in charge. You know, if you're an EMTB and you have a patient that suddenly codes on you, and it happens, you know, more frequently than anybody would like to have happen to them, but it does happen. And, you know, that leadership needs to be there. And so I can see what Chance is saying. And I think maybe in that situation, it comes off sounding awful, but it might have been, like he said, the right thing to do at the right time. I'm dealing, like I said, a lot with EMTBs right now, and a lot of them are, you know, 17, 18 years old. And what I'm dealing with right now is forcing them to actually talk to the patients. You know, we've got kids that are dealing with elderly patients, the ages of their grandparents, and they have to ask medical questions and act like medical professionals. And you know, I when I get in the back with them, I get the patient squared away and I have them sit on the bench and I sit in the captain's chair and I'm behind the patient and I kind of point to them and I put my hands out and say, as if to say, all right, this is your patient. And I sit there and watch what they're doing. But I understand that point of forcing them to move to the next step. And sometimes you have to just make them go. Chance, you have a question you want to ask? Go ahead.
I do to ask the preceptors a question. I don't want this to sound loaded anyway. I myself went through a 2-year paramedic program. Do you see with some of the, we call them the zero to hero programs down here, where you go in with nothing and 12 months later you get a gold patch on your shoulder. Do you see a difference in the quality, say, I think we talked about this a little bit earlier, but say between those people, somebody's been through a 2 or 4 year program, and beyond that, does it really just vary from person to person? You know, I mean, if you're not seeing a difference, does it vary from person to person? This is the question I'd like to ask.
Are you talking, Chance, about a program where they come in with no prior EMS knowledge and then a year later come out as a paramedic?
Yes, that's the exact kind. We have a program like that down here. It's an accelerated program. You go 4 days a week, and basically it's just you can walk in off the street January 1st and December 31st. You're ready to go.
Okay. Rick, Peter, anybody have any comments?
Yeah, I'd say that I really think that actual field experience is really necessary in order to do the job. We have some programs around here where people have become EMTs and then gone right to school, and they can be very book smart, but you get them out on the call and they just really don't know what they're doing. The other problem that we've had here, we have some paramedic programs that are 2-year programs that are very good, and then we have some programs that are very short that we call them up here shake and bake medics or chia pet medics. Just pour the water on them and you get a medic six weeks later, 6 months later. But what I found with those programs, if the people who go into them have a lot of field experience, then they do pretty well because they'll study hard on their own and they'll do okay. But generally speaking, I found that the people who have field experience and then who've gone through the 2-year programs are way ahead of the rest of the crowd.
Well, the 2-year programs are also generally degree programs. Even associate's degree programs have other requirements in English and math, so that they end up being a little more well-rounded in their total education. And I think that makes a huge difference. I think people that just go in and learn the medical skills and without learning anything else to go along with it, tend to just have like a cookbook kind of knowledge of paramedicine and don't really get all of the extra, you know, anatomy and physiology classes and maybe a microbiology class or additional sciences and then additional humanities classes to kind of round things out. And I think that makes a huge difference. It's one of the reasons I think there's kind of a move afoot in some cases to move paramedic to a 4-year degree. And I think that's something that is going to eventually need to happen to bring it into the level of other medical professionals like nursing, because I think it's still a young career. It's having trouble making that leap. Rick, do you have anything to add to the comments?
Yeah, like I just typed in the text there, both the EMT and the paramedic need to know why they're doing something, and not just how they're doing it. And just as important is why not to do something. And I firmly believe we've got to fall back on good, solid, basic education and good, solid, basic life support skills to keep us fresh as paramedics and keep us on the right track and know what to do when advanced level skills and knowledge just don't make it happen.
Chris has an interesting point in the chat room. He says that he sees there being traveling medics, that just like the RNs, that experienced RNs that get traveling jobs where they go into a locale, into a hospital, and work for 13 weeks in a given system as a traveling RN. He sees that in something similar in traveling medics that move to a system that needs to hire somebody. It's an interesting thought. You know, our service is so young in its composition. You know, we EMS has been around. When you look at the scope of medicine in general, EMS has been around for such a short period of time, and we're still evolving quite a bit into what our skill set needs to be. And, you know, and as Chance says, the founders of the program are still working on the street. And I had a thought just the other day when I was talking with is that, you know, I'm going to speak for Peter and Rick here, but I'd be hazard a guess that I could name the television program that influenced their thoughts about emergency medicine in the field. Am I correct?
Absolutely.
Right on the money.
Yeah, I mean, I got the DVDs as soon as they came out of the emergency program, Squad 51, Johnny and Roy. You know, it's when I'm working a code and I need to start giving an IV med, I flip the ends off the tubes as I'm screwing it together, because, you know, it just makes a huge bit of difference. And just is something I remember from the television show, and it's something that makes me feel like I'm right in the middle of it. And then the other night I was interviewing with for the Medicast, and she made a comment, Peter, about reading your books in high school, and that was what changed her entire career path, that she was going in one direction and decided that this is what she wanted to do based on reading your novels. And it occurred to me then that there's a whole nother generation of people coming into EMS right now that are getting their knowledge and drive to get into emergency medicine from people like Peter, people like Rick, and all the other bloggers out there that are talking about what they do on the street, that are podcasting about what they do on the street, and making it an educational experience for anybody that wants to kind of get a taste for it. And it's kind of interesting to say that, but the process has changed. All right. Who threw that out there? Was that you, Rick?
Accidentally.
Okay. Yeah. That's okay. That's the tones. There's a guy in my fire company that actually has that as his cell phone ringer. And we all, a lot of the kids look around and go, what the heck is that? But that's the tones for the television show when they would get a call. And it's one of those things that's influenced all of us. Chance, what got you into wanting to be involved with EMS, if you don't mind me asking?
I was a lifeguard whenever I was younger, and I was always CPR certified, local, involved in my local Red Cross and my local Explorer program. I actually got into the EMS Explorer because originally I thought I wanted to be a law enforcement officer. I was in the local law enforcement officer Explorer program. That ended up folding. So I just kind of hopped over to the EMS Explorer thing, and I found I really liked it. Also, whenever I was 15 years old, we're on our way out to False River, which is kind of a recreational area around here. We're going to take our boat out. We were pulled over at a shell, and a family came in off the spillway with the father of the family, who had been working in the fields and suffered what I guess was a giant MI. I never really found out about it. But we started doing CPR on them, and the local ambulance service and air service responded out here. And I remember doing CPR and looking up and seeing one of the docs get off the AirMed helicopter and walk up to the scene in his cowboy boots and just took over the scene, and they just handled it so well. And it was just amazing to see the precision. They really handled the call well. I can look back on that now as an EMT and a paramedic and see how well that they really handled that call. And that was kind of inspiring to me. So whenever my rock dreams didn't pan out, I said, well, this is, I think, what I'd like to do.
Yeah, it you know, it's funny, cowboy boots. I'm going to have to see if I can add that to our uniform. That would certainly add something to the package. But that's, you know, I think that, you know, it's the handling of the call. It's the leadership and learning to be the leader on the scene that makes us want to do what we do in some situations. And I also think it's one of those skills that one of the things that the preceptors try to impart, at least most importantly, I think on my part, the student should have the skill set, at least the knowledge base to have the skill set from their classroom participation. It's the working in the field and thinking through the individuality of every patient that I think makes the biggest difference. And speaking of CPR and cardiac arrest and running codes, that's going to be the topic of July's MedicCast Live. And I will have that scheduled here later this evening, but it'll be coming up in July. So keep your eyes open for that. Anybody else have some final comments on precepting they'd like to share about what you'd like to talk about as far as being a preceptor or a preceptee? Final few words?
I guess the only thing I'd like to add is that I find each experience is sort of a joint journey together. That the preceptor not only teaches the preceptee, but the preceptee teaches the preceptor some things. And one thing that we've always done is, you know, if we have an interesting call, then afterwards we can, you know, research it, talk about it, you know, try to find more answers to it. And I always find that that I end up learning more from precepting than if I was just going about doing my own work.
Absolutely, Peter. That's so true. I learn more when I teach than I do when I do it on my own, definitely, because I have to think it through in a different manner. Chris points out in the chat room that, you know, for preceptees to remember that we were once where they're sitting, and we do remember what it was like. And so you just need to understand that we're there to help out, definitely. Rick, any final thoughts?
Yeah, everybody's got a first day on the job. And it's our job to limit the number of first days that our students have.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. Well, I think that's been a great talk on precepting. We've really touched a lot of different information here. And I want to thank everybody for joining the show. Peter, thank you very much for taking the time to come in and join the TalkCast. Rick, as always, it's a pleasure to have you here. And Chance, thank you so much for sharing your information and with Claiborne, Chris Black, as always, in the chat room, and DVA EMTP, thank you for joining the show and listening in. For the rest of you, check back in July for the next episode of the MedicCast Live, and this weekend for the next episode of the MedicCast. If you have any comments you'd like to leave on this show, you can go ahead and email me at podmedic@mac.com and visit the MedicCast site at mediccast.com. Rick, how would they get to you over at the Mitigation Journal?
mitigationjournal.libsyn.com.
Excellent. And Peter, you're over at the Streetwatch Notes of a Paramedic blog, and they can get to you at what web address?
www.medicscribe.blogspot.com.
Excellent. And Peter, thanks again for joining us. I really appreciate you taking the time. I know you were working all day today. All right. Well, that's going to wrap things up here. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next time, scene safety, BSI.